Countries around the world are seeing mass protests in the face of economic inequality and political dissatisfaction.
People feel like democracy is failing to deliver. They feel less safe, they feel more economically vulnerable.
And some are calling for the United States to follow suit.
When public protest is organized and it's a big deal and people are passionate and peaceful about it, it often shifts the debate.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 22nd, we'll look into civil unrest on the global stage. Also on the show, recent reporting reveals the widespread use of child labor in chocolate production and highlights the misleading nature of fair trade labels.
It's very important for consumers to be informed about these issues and to understand that we're not going to buy our way out of this problem, which is to say purchasing a certified chocolate bar is not going to stop child labor and child trafficking in West Africa.
And as states push for settlements to fight the opioid epidemic, we'll hear from one attorney general on how much they'll do to ease suffering in hard-hit communities. We've got a packed podcast, so let's get to it. Hong Kong. Ecuador. Chile. Lebanon, Peru, Catalonia, South Korea, the United Kingdom, and on, people around the world are mobilizing. This year, we've seen a rise in social movements, and that includes here in the United States, where we've seen auto workers strike, a growing teachers movement, and just a few months ago, the Puerto Rican governor was forced to resign after mass demonstrations.
We're tired of the cynicism. They put down women. They put down the LGBT community. Corruption. It is insane. We are tired. We can't take it anymore.
For some, the rise in social movements is reminiscent of 1968.
Let them go! Let them go!
When protests in nearly every country took the world by storm. We don't get fooled again. It's been more than 10 years since the 2008 global economic crash, and we're supposedly living in recovery. But even in the midst of this strong economy, people are taking to the streets in 2019 and demanding change. I'm joined now by Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group. Ian, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we're also joined by Elizabeth Zechmeister, a political science professor at Vanderbilt University and director of the Latin American Public Opinion Project. Elizabeth, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Ian, when we look at the protests around the world, are there common themes that you see emerging?
I think there are a couple of big ones. The first is that a lot of these countries, maybe the economies are doing okay overall. But, you know, as we see in the United States, a lot of people in middle and working classes feel like things aren't going well for them. And in the emerging markets, particularly anti-corruption themes around that are very strong. But a second point is that the ability of technology, social media, not just to help people mobilize, but also to lead to more polarization inside societies, more anti-establishment sentiment. All the fake news, the fact that we have elections that are now run through Facebook as opposed to traditional media, that's having a really big impact in a lot of these countries. And I definitely think that you wouldn't see the kinds of numbers showing up on the streets if it weren't for that.
And when we, of course, we here on the show have been covering the protests in Hong Kong, which have been going on for months now. Are those demonstrations unique, Ian, because they're, and we're, I'm assuming here, they're less directly linked to economic factors?
In the case of Hong Kong, I mean, the economics are playing out because the Chinese government has so much more power than they did during the handover in 1997. Remember, Hong Kong used to be about 13% of the entire Chinese economy. Today, it's about 2%. And that means the Chinese government feels very comfortable changing the rules and squeezing them really hard, even if it means that they don't get a move towards the kind of representative democracy that they had been promised during the handover. They're very angry about it, and that's led to a standoff over a course of many, many months. They don't feel like the government represents them in any way, and increasingly they're right.
Liz, let's focus here on Latin America. We've seen protests in Chile and Ecuador and beyond. What are some of the factors and themes that you're noticing that have changed and added to this this moment of unrest?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that people feel like democracy is failing to deliver. They feel less safe. They feel more economically vulnerable. And at the same time, they feel that their governments are not doing enough to respond to their needs. They see high levels of political corruption, and that's causing a lot of dissatisfaction with democracy.
And when you look at public polling across Latin America, how do people feel generally, not just about their political institutions, but about their future?
Yeah, they're dissatisfied. So we ask in our survey, the America's Barometer, a question about how satisfied people are with how democracy is working in their country. And this latest round of our survey, we found that about 2 out of every 5 adults feels satisfied with how democracy is working, what it's delivering. And if we contrast that with 5 years ago, that number was 60%. So we've seen a 20 percentage point decrease in people's satisfaction with how politics is working in the country. So there's a lot of simmering discontent, and we see it bubbling up into protests in a number of countries in the region.
So most recently, those protests have bubbled up in Chile. What can you tell us about the situation on the ground there and how much that's being affected by economic inequality?
Yeah, I mean, Chile and a number of countries in the region have made some minimal strides in tackling income inequality. Latin America is one of the most unequal regions in the world, though, so there's still a real reservoir of need and sort of preference for the state to do more. And in fact, Chile stands out as a really interesting case because when we ask a question in our survey about how much the state should be doing to address problems of income inequality, Chile stands out as having a public with sort of the strongest desire for the state to intervene and implement strong policies to reduce income inequality. When we compare Chile to other countries, it ranks the highest on that metric. Chile stands out for a couple of other reasons: declining economic opportunity, loss of income. We see this in our survey data when we compare people's reports about how well they're doing now to how well they were doing 5 years ago. We see a real significant shift downward in people's economic well-being.
And Liz, in Ecuador, there was an indigenous-led protest movement that was largely successful. After a relatively short amount of time, the government backed away from much of its austerity measures and invited some of these activists to the table. Is this a unique situation?
It's not entirely unique. I mean, the governments in the region are facing some difficult choices. They've overseen an era over the last 10 to 15 years where there was some economic growth. There were some redistributive programs. Those programs were delivering. They were having some impact on some positive impact on people's lives. And now these countries are facing some challenges with respect to having to sort of, write their books and consider some adjustments. And Ecuador is a great example of that. Economic growth has stalled. Redistributive programs, social assistance have been pulled back. And people know it. They're experiencing it. Food insecurity has increased in Ecuador. The government attempted to make an adjustment that threatened to hurt pocketbooks of vulnerable populations, and the people mobilized, and the government is, I suppose, attempting to strike some middle ground.
Ian, in Latin America in particular, I'm curious, what role has an institution like the International Monetary Fund played in perpetuating economic inequality there?
Well, on the one hand, it's played a very big role in being able to allow governments to continue to stay afloat, have access to the international credit markets, debt markets, for example. But, you know, as you see in Ecuador, the willingness to actually respond positively to continue to provide for the social safety net for these indigenous people means that they're going to be under more pressure with being able to continue to benefit from IMF credit, debt. And that's a real problem for them. I mean, the pressure that comes once you are in a real fiscal crunch, when the IMF is telling you you've got to have austerity, you've got to be able to make your budgets work, you're going to have to repay this debt, while the people are saying, after all of these years of kleptocracy, you have to make the democracy work for us. This is an enormous problem. It's going to be a huge problem in Argentina after upcoming elections when Fernandez almost certainly wins and isn't going to be able to produce for his people. unfortunately, once you start mismanaging your economy in a relatively poor environment, the spiral grows pretty quickly.
And Ian, we haven't talked yet about Lebanon. Estimated that 1.3 million people, or a fifth of the entire population, protested there over the weekend. What are the roots of those protests?
Well, the immediate roots were a tax being put on a popular app on smartphones, but it's much deeper than that. Again, here it is services not being seen as being provided by the government. Last time you had big demonstrations, it was against people that were not picking up trash around the streets, and so as a consequence of persistent, extraordinary smell and health problems. Now it's, I would say it's much broader than that, but the same exact dynamic where you have the leader of the country, Saad Hariri, who is trying very hard to respond to the demands of the people. Is they're going to take significant cuts in terms of salaries of government officials. Yeah, that's a useful thing. They're going to raise some money through bank taxation, and the banks are okay with it because they know they've got a problem if they don't in terms of domestic stability. But their ability to make good on creation of new jobs and subsidies to the people, given how little money is actually available, how much less the Saudis and others are prepared to fund them, the fact the Americans aren't really all that interested in expanding our footprint in this part of the world right now, as I'm sure you know, all of those things make it so much more difficult for a government like Lebanon to be able to really string the eye of that needle.
I want to ask both of you, actually, in your respective areas of expertise here, whether or not you see these protests leading to political shifts, particularly more towards the far right. We're seeing that in Europe, in Italy in particular. France has had a strong far right movement for quite some time. In Latin America, we see Bolsonaro at the helm in Brazil. Do either of you see these protests really leading to that type of political change going forward? Ian?
I see it leading to more anti-establishment parties and sentiment. Much of it is on the far right, but certainly not all. I mean, in Greece, you got Syriza on the very far left, pretty unprecedented in Greece for a party like that to run. Of course, in Spain, we've had Podemos doing very well, but we've also had more recently the rise of Vox in terms of anti-immigrant sentiment. I think what you see is a hollowing out of the establishment, and reflecting in the United States, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, that process is a lot more polarized in a lot of the weaker and poorer economies around the world.
Liz, your thoughts on what Ian just said there regarding political shifts. And I'm also curious if you think that we've seen a lot of climate change movement throughout the world, but particularly in Latin America, we know that this is something in Brazil, in particular in the Amazon, whether or not you think that will also lead to more protests.
I think in the Latin American region, it's not so much a question of will these leaders be ideologically on the left or on the right. I think the real important question is how democratic will they be? And what we've seen time and time again is that when the public turns sour on democratic institutions and practices, they become more supportive of, or at least more tolerant of, elected officials whose actions undermine what are already weak institutions. In terms of climate change, what we see in the Latin America and Caribbean region is a high degree of concern with what climate change might mean for the country's future. And this is certainly going to be an issue that governments today and going forward are going to need to address satisfactorily in the region in order to maintain the confidence of the people.
Elizabeth Zechmeister is a political science professor at Vanderbilt University and director of the Latin American Public Opinion Project. And Ian Bremmer is the president of Eurasia Group. Ian, Elizabeth, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
The pharmaceutical industry just narrowly missed its day in federal court. On Monday, two Ohio counties reached a $260 million settlement with opioid distributors McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, as well as the Israeli drug manufacturer Teva Pharmaceuticals. The deal came hours before the first federal opioid trial was set to begin. Herman Lopez is a senior correspondent at Vox, and he joins me now to talk about the settlement and where this money will go. Herman, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks all for having me.
So what happened to the trial? How did they reach a settlement at the last minute?
So over the weekend, there was talk about doing a much bigger settlement over the 2,000-plus lawsuits that are currently in front of federal court right now. And in the end, they managed to get a deal, but only for these two counties. So two jurisdictions out of the 2,300, 2,400 that are actually doing lawsuits right now.
And does the settlement indicate that we'll see future settlements or anything towards what we might see from a larger master settlement? We know in the next segment we're going to be talking a little bit about attorneys general in other states and what they're trying to do.
It certainly seems like it. If you just look at how this played out, these are two jurisdictions out of 2,300 plus, and they got a $260 million settlement. If you extrapolate that out, like do that bit by bit, so if pharmaceutical companies have to do these settlements two at a time for the next 1,200 so times, I mean, that's going to be a lot of money, a lot of time, and nobody wants to do that. Not the pharmaceutical companies who would have to waste a lot of money on litigation, and not the other side, which wants to get this money out to deal with the opioid epidemic as quickly as possible. So I think that it might take a little while, it might take a few months from now, but we will probably start seeing a master settlement soon.
In addition to, you just mentioned that a lot of these pharmaceutical companies not wanting to spend the money on litigation, I'm wondering if part of the calculation here was not wanting to be in the hot seat for what could have been a long trial and potentially something that could be damaging to their reputation and their name. Do you think that was part of the calculation to settle?
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, one thing with these settlements so far is that they have not included an admission of guilt. And the longer you're in trial, the longer these pharmaceutical companies might feel like they're looking guilty as more evidence is presented as the media is reporting on it. So at least this way, they do have to pay a lot of money. It's a sizable amount of money, but it's not, they don't necessarily look as bad as they would otherwise.
Where's the money supposed to go?
This is a big question. So it's supposed to go to alleviating the opioid epidemic, but back in the 90s, there was a master settlement regarding tobacco companies. And a lot of that money ended up going to really frivolous stuff. In fact, in some states, the money actually ended up going to tobacco farmers, which is not what the settlement was originally intended for. This would be like the opioid money in some way going back to opioid makers or something like that. That's something that's probably going to be a big topic of conversation and negotiations in the next few months. But it is supposed to go to addressing the opioid epidemic, whether that's addiction treatment, prevention, or something else.
Armand, you've been covering this for a while, and I'm sure you've heard from families about this. What are they feeling? Is it enough?
They have mixed feelings about it. I think people are a little surprised in terms of like how much money is actually being given out now. Like, it is a sizable amount of money, and some people were worried that there wouldn't be enough. But people, like I said, they're kind of upset that there's no admission of guilt. There are increasing calls by activists to do criminal trials to hold some of these executives and companies criminally liable. And there's just a sense that, yes, you're getting this money now, but there's not really a sense of justice out of it.
Herman Lopez is a senior correspondent at Vox. Herman, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're continuing our coverage of settlement deals from opioid distributors and manufacturers now. And I'm joined by North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein. Attorney General Stein has been one of four state attorneys general working to reach a $48 billion settlement from opioid distributors AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and McKesson Corporation, and manufacturers Johnson & Johnson and Teva. The settlement would cover more than 2,300 cases against these companies that are part of a massive consolidated lawsuit. Attorney General Stein, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Tanzina, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So you and others have been pushing for a larger collective settlement worth $48 billion. That's billion with a B. What would the settlement entail?
It would entail both cash and non-cash, all dedicated to trying to help people who are sick with opioid addiction. This is an absolutely devastating crisis, and it's affecting communities all across this country, including here in North Carolina, where families are struggling, communities are suffering with their budgets, and individuals are sick, and too many are dying. We lose about five people every day to an opioid overdose, and so it is imperative that we get the resources we need so we can start helping people who are sick because of the acts of these drug companies. The $48 billion includes $22 billion in cash payments over time to go to abatement activities, anything that can help people who are sick, and then $26 billion in products and services, mainly medication-assisted drugs, Suboxone, which is the leading drug for people sick with opioid addiction, and it will help them get healthy. And so this is a way for us to bring to bear real resources that can make a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, one of the big questions, as we heard in the previous segment here, is to make sure that the money actually goes to what it's intended to go to, Attorney General. What steps can be taken to ensure that that happens, that the money goes to those most directly impacted by the opioid epidemic rather than other parts of the state budget?
Yes, I could not agree more. I've seen it here, even in my home state of North Carolina. The legislature took our Health and Wellness Trust, which was dedicated to promote community health as a result of the tobacco settlement 20 years ago, and after about 12, 13 years, they just took it and absorbed it into the state budget. So I share those concerns deeply. And so the way we're proposing to structure this is to have what we call buckets. There are a bunch of counties and cities that have sued. There are a number of states that have sued. And so each of those groups would get some amount of money, but the majority of the money would go to what we call the Common Abatement Fund. And these would be dedicated to activities that help people. Either it helps people move from prison into drug treatment programs. It helps get naloxone into communities to keep people alive. It funds treatment programs for people who are sick. Anything that is a long list of potential acceptable activities that go to address the crisis. That's why we're calling it an abatement fund. And even the state and the county funds need to be spent on abatement. And that is an important priority for us all.
In response to your announcement of a tentative agreement, Paul J. Hanley Jr., who is a lawyer that represents multiple cities and counties in their lawsuits against opioid companies, had a skeptical response. He told the New York Times, and I'm quoting here, "The proposed deal put forth is nothing more than wishful thinking on the part of AGs who were 20 months too late to this party." Attorney General Stein, what's your response to that criticism?
Well, he has a specific agenda, and he has certain clients, and I'm sure he wants his clients to get, to win the lottery. And basically, when you have individual counties and cities that are suing, those two counties in Ohio, they won the lottery. And there's absolutely no way, if you were to liquidate every single one of these drug companies and come up with every dollar of value, you would not be able to solve the problem. And we would not be able to come up with the sums that the first counties and cities are going to earn in their litigation. This is not a problem that's limited to Cuyahoga County in Ohio. This is a national problem. And so what we have to do is maximize the amount of resources that we can extract from these companies and then distribute it in a rational and fair way to have the maximum impact on people's lives, but also that's fair and gets sent around the country. I mean, if we just allow these cities and counties to go forward with each of their lawsuits and they don't participate in a national settlement, what will happen is that they will each win massive settlements, and then the companies will be bankrupt. So seven or eight jurisdictions will get all of the money, leaving the rest of the entire nation in the dark. And these drug distributors are absolutely critical to the healthcare system in the United States. The Cardinal, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen distribute 80-90% of every pharmaceutical from the manufacturers to the pharmacy. And, I mean, opioids is just one drug. Think of every single drug that happens in this country. It goes through those three companies. And if we bankrupt them, we run the risk of disrupting the entire healthcare delivery in the United States, which is something that I refuse to do.
Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, reached a tentative deal last month that would cost the owners of the company, the Sackler family, $3 billion of their own money and would also see them give up ownership of the company. To what you were just saying, Attorney General, what do you think of that deal?
I didn't think it was enough. I did not think the Sackler family was held sufficiently accountable. They extracted billions out of this company, throwing the company into bankruptcy, and now they're trying to shield their private assets in the process. and that's wrong. They need to step up in a meaningful way to address this crisis, because I believe that they are as or more responsible than any other people in the country to what's happening.
We've got about 30 seconds left. One thing that's happened recently with these settlements is that a lot of these companies are not having their day in court and are not being forced to admit guilt. Do you believe that that should happen, that there should be? Is that a flaw in this approach to push settlements instead of trials?
Well, I think that what's important is to try to save people's lives and to do it in a urgent fashion. And we can litigate these matters for years and years and years, and then hopefully someday at the end of the rainbow get money. But meanwhile, thousands of my North Carolina residents are going to be dead, and I refuse to accept that. I do accept that the documents need to be made public and part of a public understanding of what happened. But I think there's no question the way forward is a national resolution that brings meaningful resources distributed in a fair and rational manner.
Attorney General Josh Stein, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for your interest.
With Halloween nearly a week away, you may be one of the many Americans planning to give out candy to trick-or-treaters. But do you know where that chocolate you're handing out actually comes from and who's laboring to harvest the cocoa it's made from? For most chocolate, the production chain begins in West Africa. Nearly two-thirds of the entire world's cocoa production comes from that region, and the majority of that comes from the Ivory Coast. But there's growing concern about labor practices in cocoa farming. According to government estimates, there are more than 2 million children laboring in cocoa farms throughout West Africa. Journalists and NGOs have been exposing these troubling labor practices in the region for years, but lately there's been a renewed push to expose and end them. I'm joined now by Peter Wariski, staff writer at The Washington Post, and earlier this year, Peter visited Côte d'Ivoire and exposed the widespread use of child labor in cocoa farms. Peter, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. Thank you for having me.
I'm also joined by Charity Ryerson, legal director and founder of the Corporate Accountability Lab. And this year, Charity was also in Côte d'Ivoire looking into the labor conditions at cocoa farms. Charity, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So, Peter, let's start with you. Tell us about your investigation. How many cocoa farms did you visit, and what were your top line findings there?
It's hard to count how many there are because they're very small farms are in the forest, dozens at least. The top line finding was, though the chocolate companies and the cocoa industry promised 20 years ago to eradicate child labor from the West African cocoa supply, it's still there in abundant numbers. Some of these are kids who are working on their parents' farms, some of them not going to school, but the most tragic cases are probably the kids who are coming in from Mali or Burkina Faso, who come alone. They're between the ages of 10 and 15 years old and live in fairly deplorable conditions picking or harvesting cocoa.
Charity, you also did research in Côte d'Ivoire, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on what Peter was saying and tell us a little bit about what the labor conditions look like on the cocoa farms that you visited.
Yeah, we visited five different cocoa-growing villages over the past year and a half, and those villages represented about 18,000 cocoa farmers. We talked to tribal leaders, farmers, women farmers, children, a lot of different stakeholders, hired labor. And what we saw was really extraordinary and I think consistent with Peter's finding, which is just that the level of poverty that these farmers are living in is often similar to indentured servitude. So people are just working to pay off their last season's debts. Hired laborers are working for something that is just utterly unlivable. A lot of children didn't have shoes. We just saw very difficult conditions. And in the end, our analysis was that these farmers just lacked any power to be able to negotiate for better prices. And these very, very low prices were what was creating the conditions that made child and forced labor so rampant.
Peter, you spoke to children who are working in these cocoa farms. What did they tell you?
The ones we talked to, we focused on the kids who were coming in from Burkina Faso. They generally very poor families. They got on a bus, told that they'd get some money and they might even get some schooling. They took the bus. They end up in terrible conditions. They're not going to school. They're making barely enough to pay for what they might be able to eat. Huts would be two grand a word for where they were living. They were drinking water that was cloudy, milky, just pulled up from dirty streams. Really terrible conditions for these kids, and many of them seemed sort of traumatized.
Let's talk about the scope of the chocolate and cocoa industry. How big is this industry that we're talking about, and who's buying this cocoa that's being harvested by kids?
Well, we all are. It's a $100 billion industry. None of the big cocoa or chocolate companies, Nestle, Hershey, Mars, knows actually where their West African cocoa is coming from. And so if you don't know where it's coming from, you can't eradicate child labor from the supply chain. The U.S. Department of Labor has done studies. They found 2 million kids working in Ghana and Ivory Coast. It's just everywhere.
Charity, you are the legal director and the founder of the Corporate Accountability Lab. How is it that these multinational mega corporations don't know, to Peter's point, that there's child labor involved in the sourcing of the cocoa that we all are consuming?
I think they do know. I think every multinational who is sourcing cocoa from West Africa knows that there's a significant amount of child labor in those supply chains, and that none of the initiatives that they have taken thus far have eradicated that child labor, and they continue to engage in the same practices regardless of that fact.
So let's talk a little bit about the historical precedent here. Have companies attempted to make real change to these labor conditions, Charity?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's sort of a scandalous story here, which is that for the last 20 years since the Harkin-Engel Protocol, there have been all of these corporate social responsibility initiatives, lots of different voluntary actions. Companies have committed to get rid of child labor by various dates that keep getting pushed back. They have committed to buying more certified cocoa. And each of these activities has done very little. So if you look at the impact of all of these initiatives, you find that the companies are not showing demonstrated results of their efforts. And so ultimately what they're doing is they're doing small projects in certain places across the country that creates this piecemeal system with no real accountability. In the end, when we went to these farms, we even went to farms that were certified, and we saw that the conditions were almost identical to those that were not certified. So earlier this year, when we visited a number of villages, we brought with us a number of different chocolate products. But in particular, we brought a regular Hershey bar, and then we brought a Fairtrade certified chocolate bar. And we held each of those bars up in each village, and we were talking to tribal leadership and farmers, and we explained what each of these chocolate bars meant to consumers, and that the label, we talked about the price difference between the Fairtrade certified bar and the uncertified bar, and that consumers, when they see that label, believe that means that farmers earn a living wage, have access to health care, that their children go to school and don't work on the farm, et cetera. And the reaction of the farmers was really just pure outrage. People stood up, people yelled, one man pulled on his shirt to show how worn it was and stained and torn and said, "Does it look like I make a living wage?" And so the idea that consumers were being misled in this way to think that fair trade or that a certification meant that they were buying an ethical product was not just problematic from a misleading consumer standpoint, but for farmers, it was really, I would say, morally offensive and outrageous. So I think that's scandalous. I think if we look at the amount of leeway that companies have gotten from regulators as a result of all of these voluntary actions and how little impact it's had, it really raises a question. Why are we still listening to their voluntary commitments?
Peter, I'm just curious if the workers, particularly the child laborers that you've spoken to or the farmers who are sort of being shortchanged here, are they aware of how their product is being used and sold at a premium, basically, by these multinational corporations?
I don't think so. There's some videos you can see them on YouTube of kids who've, you know, some of these child laborers, and they've just having chocolate for the first time. It's not like chocolate is part of their lives. They're really just focused on really basic human subsistence questions and not the larger global trade issues. We're working on a story about the certification effort. You know, basically certification works by saying, we're going to set out some rules for how cocoa will be done. We're not going to have child labor. We're not going to have deforestation. And then there's third-party inspectors that are supposed to make sure you're living up to the rules. And this is what the chocolate companies have all said. We're going to go to 100% certification or some large percentage. And that certification effort has been, in many ways, a mask, or it's a failure, because some of their own research shows that there's actually more child laborers on the certified farms.
Is there more that can be done here, here in the United States? I'm thinking on a couple of levels, whether that's pressuring these multinational corporations to do more. Is there more that can be done to inform consumers? Is there more that can be done at the congressional level?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has to be done at the congressional level. It's very important for consumers to be informed about these issues and to understand that we're not going to buy our way out of this problem, which is to say purchasing a certified chocolate bar is not going to stop child labor and child trafficking in West Africa. But instead, we need to be communicating in clear ways to the companies, but also to our representatives, that we need some regulatory action here.
Peter, could this problem shift somewhere else? Is there somewhere else that cocoa could be farmed, which is more sustainable and more humane than what we're seeing happen in Cote d'Ivoire in particular?
That's a good question. Yes, we'll really find out soon. The U.S. is currently investigating whether or not there is enough evidence of child labor, forced child labor. And if they do make that finding, they can stop all imports of any products that are cocoa or involve cocoa from getting into the United States, in which case they will have to find a replacement for what happens to be the largest source in the world.
Peter Wariski is a staff writer at The Washington Post, and Charity Ryerson is the legal director and founder of the Corporate Accountability Lab. Peter, Charity, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, we're also hearing from you on ethical production and the role it plays in your spending habits.
My name is Monica from Lebanon, Oregon. Ethical production is extremely important to me, no matter the product. I try to educate myself as much as possible so that I can be an intentional consumer. However, I often feel constrained by finances and unable to reconcile my beliefs with my budget.
Hi, this is Max Romano, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Conflict-free is as important as divesting from oil or leather. You must vote with your dollar.
Keep calling us to weigh in. Our number, as always, is 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also write to us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.